Okay, ladies and gentlemen, welcome back from lunch to our afternoon session. And I am chairing this afternoon session. My name is Matti Kuorelahti, and I welcome you to come back to this issue of Global Monitoring Report 2012. And this report will be published first time in Finland in this seminar, which we are also, of course, very happy about it. I'm thankful for the UNESCO Commission of Finland and UNESCO headquarters, Paris. And Professor Kwame Akyampong has just arrived here to participate in this seminar and to give a presentation of the Global Monitoring Report on skills and employment and youth issues. Dr. Akyampong is a professor in the University of Sussex, and he was the director of the Center of International Education. And now he's been working in UNESCO headquarters for this year's and also next year's GMRs. So thank you for offering your time visiting us, Jyväskylä and Finland. And now I give you the floor. And after Dr. Kwame's presentation, there is a chance for you to give questions. And we have two microphones here, which will be delivered to you. And we ask you to be silent so far that you will have the microphone in your hands, because we have international virtual audience also all the time following us. We don't know where, but it is online in the web. And that's why if they only see that somebody gave a presentation, so they will be very angry if they don't hear what was asked. So remember that we have also this online audience, and let's keep them happy also in the net so that everybody can follow the presentations here. But Professor Akyampong, you're welcome.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much. Thank you for welcoming me to this launch of the Global Monitoring Report 2012. This is my first time in Finland, and I'm really privileged to be here. And I've really enjoyed listening to the sessions this morning. Incidentally, some of the issues that were discussed this morning are issues that will be captured in the next Global Monitoring Report, which will be on teaching and learning for sustaining development. So it was very encouraging to hear some of the discussions that were taking place. I would like to welcome you to the launch of the 10th EFA report. It's been 10 years since the Global Monitoring Report has been launched, and this is the 10th edition. And as you can see, there's already conversations going on this year's report. You can follow the conversations on Twitter. There is also something on the hashtag, which you see in blue. And we'll encourage you to follow some of the issues that are being raised by people who have listened to the report or have read the report, and also make a contribution. Let me start by saying that the Education for All Global Movement, which established the six EFA goals, also put into motion a process where every year we would evaluate progress that has been made as far as these goals are concerned. We had 164 governments in 2000 in Dakar agree on these goals. And what we do with the EFA reports is to take stock of how much progress has been made. And as we approach 2015 in particular, I think it's very, very important that we pay attention to the progress that has been made, but also the challenges that remain if we are to meet the goals that were set. In my presentation today, I'll be looking at three things. The first is to look at the progress that has been made towards EFA, the six EFA goals. So I'll try and give a global analysis of the progress and some of the challenges that still remain. I'll then talk about the financing of the of EFA, because this is really at the heart of the challenges that many countries face towards the achievement of the goals. So we'll look at what the situation is as far as the financing goes. And then thirdly, I would focus on the theme for this year, which is on skills, youth skills and work. Every year, the EFA report picks up a topical issue and gives it special attention. And this year, we focused on youth skills and work. And I think it's pertinent, given what we know is already happening on the world stage, with a lot of challenges facing young people and their access to work. So that's how this presentation would be would go. Now, what are the key messages of this year's report? And we have four main messages. And I think before I get into the details, is to say that progress towards EFA is stagnating. I mean, all the evidence that we have in the report suggests that even though we started making good progress at the beginning, there is a lot of concern because the progress appears to be stagnating. As a result of that, many young people have been left without education and consequently without the skills that they need to find work. And this is worrying, and I think this is something that needs attention. One of the things we also focus on in this report is marginalized or disadvantaged youth. And we think that in particular, even though some countries are making progress, those who are disadvantaged are lagging behind. And it's important that we pay attention to them. The second important message is that aid to education is slowing down. Now, we would show from this presentation why aid is important for many countries that are struggling to make to meet the goals. The worrying thing, though, is that aid that many rich countries promised to support the goals, to ensure that no country that wants to make progress but lacks resources will be denied those resources. Unfortunately, aid to education is slowing down, and I'll be sharing some of the reasons why. Third point is what I've already said, that because of the slow progress, it has left a huge number of young people without the skills they need for work, and this is creating another set of challenges and problems for the world. Finally, we have put a lot of emphasis also on the poor and rural youth. We did that because there is great concern that as countries make progress, the new challenges that are confronting young people, especially in the rural context, and particularly if they are women, is growing. And if we are going to do something about giving young people skills, then we need to pay attention to the urban and rural youth to support them with skills. So in a nutshell, the message really is that there is the need for us to enhance the efforts to reach EFA by 2015. But more importantly, as this report shows, that equity has to be at the center of the effort because it appears that as progress has been made, those who are much more disadvantaged in society have been left behind. And I think that's a very important message that we want to highlight. Let me now look at the goals one by one. Let's start with the early childhood care and education. Now, starting at the beginning, we all know that early childhood care and education is vital to give children a good start in life. When we miss that foundation level, many children already, their futures have been already determined in terms of whether they will have they will succeed in life or not. So early childhood is very important. However, this goal is even clearly off track. I mean, the evidence that we present suggests that in 2010, for example, less than half of children of pre-primary school age went to preschool. And the poorest were worst off in many cases. We are finding that less than one in six children went to preschool in low-income countries. So this is a challenge that still confronts many low-income countries. And children we know who are hungry, malnourished, or ill are not in the position to learn or to gain skills. And I think this is something that needs attention, as the report makes very clearly. Some of the evidence we have is what you have on the screen. We have about 171 million children who are affected by stunting in 2010, We know that children, once the effect of stunting kicks in, it's very difficult to correct that. In fact, you cannot correct that. And that has implications for their learning. So unless something is done about this, this is going to really create a problem. We know that in 2011, for example, there was a vicious hunger crisis throughout Africa, which particularly is affecting the young. And this raises concern for the world. And it is estimated from our analysis that by 2015, around a quarter of children under the age of 5 will be suffering from stunting. So that is a really big challenge that we face. And that's something that I think we need to pay particular attention to. Now, one of the things we've looked at is to also address the issue of progress towards early childhood goals across certain indices. And as you see in this slide, we have looked at three dimensions in the report, three dimensions that help us to look at how some countries are making progress towards in the area of health, in the area of nutrition, and in education. And the Global Monitor Report team has put together these three dimensions to produce an index to show how countries are faring with respect to this. So the three indices are under 5 survival rate. We've used under 5 survival rate. We've also used children under 5 not suffering from moderate or severe stunting. And finally, we've also included age-specific enrollment ratio of children. And the ECCE index is an average of these three. And as you can see from the graph, you have countries that are in Niger, for example, is really at the bottom as far as these indices are concerned. You have countries like the Philippines and Cameroon, and then as you move up, the indices change. But it is also pointing to the fact that in order to ensure that children have opportunity, you need to look at not simply health, simply education, you need to look at health, education, and nutrition as the three important dimensions that can address the issue about the opportunities that children have right from the beginning. The next goal is universal primary education, goal 2. Now, we can say with confidence that despite the global attention to UPE, the world would not reach universal primary education by 2015. I think the analysis points to that, and we are going to miss that goal. Definitely. In 71 countries, we have fewer than 80% of children of school age who entered school in 2010. 80% of children of official age who entered school in 2010. Now, if you think that even for these children, if they enter school in the next 3 years, they will not be able to complete before 2015. We already have 47 out of 100 who are expected never to enroll. For every 100 of these students, 47 will not even enroll. So all this is pointing to the fact that the goal that the international community, the world set itself to achieve UPE by 2015 is really not going to happen. One of the biggest problems that has been identified in our analysis is dropout, the incidence of dropout, which seems to be a problem that is really dragging many countries and making it difficult for them to reach the goals. I'll be highlighting some of the issues around dropout. One of the other things that we've picked up in our analysis is the issue of late entry. In many low-income countries, especially in sub-Saharan Africa, children are not entering school at the age at which you would expect them to, the official age. And that has consequences on whether they stay on and complete, especially for girls. This has serious implications for them in terms of completion. And this is something that we've picked up particularly in Africa. And as the slide shows, that we have about 41% in sub-Saharan Africa who start school 2 or more years late. And the analysis clearly shows that this has implications for whether they will complete or not. Now, we can look more closely at goal number 2 and see what is really happening. I mentioned the issue about the dropouts as a problem undermining progress towards the goals. Now, what does it actually look like? Now, if you look at goal 2 more closely from the point of view of dropouts, the number of out-of-school children of primary school age, as this graph shows, fell from 108 million in 1999 to 61 million in 2010. So there's been a drop, and as you can see, fairly all the countries, all the regions have made progress as far as reducing the number of out-of-school children. But the important thing to note with this is that three-quarters of this reduction occurred between 1999 and 2004. Okay? Now, when you move further on, you can see that it is stagnating, it is slowing. The rate of decline slowed considerably from 2004 to 2008, and you can see that from that point, the decline was really slowing down. And then from 2008 onwards, actually the progress has stalled, as the graph shows. And from 2008, it has stalled. But you can clearly also see that for sub-Saharan Africa, it is beginning to rise up again. It's beginning to go up. And so this is worrying, I think, for as far as the goal to try and reduce considerably the number of children who are out of school. But it's interesting to compare South and West Asia and Sub-Saharan Africa, which started at similar positions in 1999. Both of them were at similar positions. But they have progressed in very differently. And this raises concern about what is happening, particularly in Sub-Saharan Africa. Between 1999 and 2008, we know that the number of out-of-school children in South and West Asia fell by 26 million, while it fell by 30 million in Sub-Saharan Africa. And one of the interesting things that the analysis this year is showing that half of all those out-of-school children live in Sub-Saharan Africa. Half of them, of the number of out-of-school children globally, live in Sub-Saharan Africa. And I think this is important to bear in mind, because that's where we think the problem is concentrated and needs attention. Now, let's look at countries where this problem is really concentrated and what has happened, because they have followed different trajectories as far as the reduction in out-of-school children is concerned. Now, if you take four countries, these four countries report the largest number of out-of-school children in the world. They are Nigeria, Pakistan, Ethiopia, and India. If you look at Nigeria, in 2001, it had 6.9% of out-of-school children. It's now risen to about 10.5%. And then if you take a country like Pakistan, it started from 8.4, it's now gone down to 5.1. Take Ethiopia, it started from 6.1. Ethiopia has made considerable progress, even though it still has still a lot of challenges. By 2010, it had 2.4 out-of-school children. And then India has reduced from 20.3 to 2.3. So these are countries that had quite huge out-of-school population, but they've all followed slightly different trajectories. I think the important point to make is that in Nigeria, the number of out-of-school children increased by more than 50%, with 3.6 million children out of school in 2010 as compared to 2000. So Nigeria is beginning to experience a shift in the number of out-of-school children. And this is really part of the problem, I think that's part of the reason why we have such a huge number in Sub-Saharan Africa. Let's now turn our attention to goal number three. Now, we can say that despite the huge advances that were made, have been made since 1999, again, progress in reducing the number of out-of-school adolescents has also stagnated. So the number of out-of-school adolescents is also stagnating since 2007. Now, this year's report focuses on young people. So when I get to the section where we're talking about the theme, I'll shed some more light on that. But we know that of the 71 million adolescents who were out of school in 2010, three-quarters lived in Southwest Asia and Sub-Saharan Africa. So again, the problem is concentrated in Southwest Asia and Sub-Saharan Africa in particular. And this is where I think we need to focus attention on. Now, on goal four, which is adult literacy, we also have found that this goal is likely to be missed by most countries, and some by a very large margin. actually. We from our analysis, know that about 775 million adults still cannot read or write. And sadly, 2 in 3 of them are women. And this proportion has remained unchanged for a very long time. So we are not making progress sufficiently in this area. But let me just also say that the problem is not restricted to developing countries. Some of our analysis that we've done in this year's report indicates that poor literacy skills is also a problem in richer countries, in the OECD countries. We have about 160 million young adults who do not have enough literacy skills to be able to fill even a job application form in the OECD countries. So as you look in the report, you find we have some analysis which would suggest that among young people particularly, this is something that needs to be tackled if we are going to address the problems. Now this graph reinforces the point that I've made that most countries will miss goal 4 by a large margin. But there are some countries that are doing better than others. Of the 73 countries where we have adult literacy data, which we analyzed from 1998 to 2001 and 2008 to 2011, 40 countries already have literacy rates which are below 90% in the earlier period. Now, of these countries, only 3 of them are expected to meet the goal of halving adult literacy by 2015. And the countries we've identified, some of them, the key ones are Bolivia, Equatorial Guinea, and Malaysia. You can see from that if you take a country like Chad, it had an adult literacy rate of around 74% between 1998 and 2001. Its aim was to, the projection was to reduce this to 61% by 2015. What we have is that it is well below the target that it set of 37%. And as you can see from this graph, many of these countries are well below the targets that they have set. By 2015, it's very unlikely that they are going to meet these goals. In fact, some of these countries, 6 of them we've identified, will miss it by a very wide margin, by more than, say, 15%. Countries like Democratic Republic of Congo, Madagascar, Central African Republic, Papua New Guinea, Chad, and Mali. So this is something that is already causing concern, and I think as we look forward to 2015, it's something that we need to address urgently. Goal 5. I think Goal 5 is the biggest success story of EFA goals. A lot of countries have made a lot of progress, and that's the, if there's any good news we have, it is that Goal 5, there's been good progress. But the Arab states, again, and Sub-Saharan Africa are still lagging behind. In these regions, more progress is needed to ensure that girls and young women have equal opportunities. I think this is a problem that is persistent throughout many African countries. But we're also beginning to see that boys are increasingly also becoming disadvantaged. In over half of the 97 countries that have not achieved gender parity in secondary education, for example, boys are becoming disadvantaged. And I think this is something that needs to focus our attention on what to do. One of the concerns that has come to the fore as we move to, as we progress towards, or as we move closely towards 2015, is the issue of quality. And we know that while quantity has increased for many countries, access has become much more widespread. The goal of ensuring that when children go to school, they learn has not made similar progress. As a result, we have millions of children who go to school and do not learn the basics. I think this is really a problem. We are getting children who are walking through the door of education but are not learning as much as we would expect them to learn. And our evidence from our analysis shows that learning achievements are basically determined by the socioeconomic status of families. and that the higher the socioeconomic level of the child, the better their performance, with similar patterns for boys and girls. And we are finding that teachers, the issue about teachers is also very important. In 33 countries, as you see on the slide, less than three quarters of the primary school teachers were trained to the national standard. So I think there is much more that needs to be done in trying to improve quality. And like I said, next year, our report will focus on much more closely on some of the issues around quality and what can be done to address these problems of quality. Now, what we also did was to look at recent regional and international surveys to provide a basis for comparing learning outcomes at primary education across countries. And this next slide focuses on mathematics and to see how much progress is being made. And again, you can see that in most of the richer countries, at least the children who are surviving to grade four and achieving the minimum level of learning is much higher than if you have in the other regions of the world. And so, but there's still, in each of these countries, there's still an issue of children progressing sufficiently to grade four and achieving the standards that have been set for that level. Malawi is an example of where you have 34% of the children do not reach grade four. You take every 100, 34 don't even reach grade four. So they don't have enough education even for them to acquire the basic skills for them to succeed. So I think as far as quality is concerned, all the indications are that we are slowing down, we are not making sufficient progress, and some countries are really struggling to improve quality for children. This year we have developed what we call the World Inequality Database on education-wide, and I'll encourage you to go to the website and you can check for different countries as far, how far they are doing as far as these indicators are concerned. What we did in the team was to come out with 9 indicators, and I'll just read them out for you. The 9 indicators are what we use to put countries on this scale to see how far they are doing as far as the disparities in relation to education is concerned. We have, if you go to the site, you have something on the mean years of education which is less than 2 years of schooling, which is here, which is what on the screen, which I'll explain shortly. Those who have had less than 4 years of schooling, those who are in the bottom 20% of education, et cetera, et cetera. Now, if you look at this, you can see, for example, that in Niger, the national average it's obviously below 50%, but there's quite a big disparity between the poorest and the richest, and between female and male. So what the wide is showing is that if you disaggregate the national average, you begin to see just how wide the disparities are. In particular, if you live in a rural area, or if you live in an urban area, and also if you're a woman, or if you're a girl, or if you're a boy, the differences are really stark. And you can see how countries compare. For example, Pakistan. If you are poor in Pakistan, and you're female, your opportunities as far as education is concerned, and it's really different for a boy or a male. But the richest tend to have a narrow distribution. I think this is something that we need to pay attention to, because it draws attention, as you can see from this, the unacceptable levels of education inequality across countries and between groups within countries. And I think we need to be looking at policies that can address this. One of the things that is clearly coming out is that if countries are going to make progress, then they need to focus a lot more attention on the disadvantage. Without that, that progress that they expect would not happen. And I think this is one major story that is coming from our analysis. Let me now move on to the issue of financing, because I have just given you an overview of where we are as far as these goals are concerned, but also highlighted just how challenging it is now for us to meet those goals by 2015. But one of the things that we have emphasized in this year's report that financing of education really is at the heart of countries that are making progress and countries that are stagnating. And this is a story that needs to be told and made very clear. We've been able to show that a key determinant of whether countries improve access and learning is the amount they spend on education. So, for example, in Tanzania, which increased its GDP to education from 2% in 1999 to 6.9% in 2010, it managed, as a result of doing that, reduce out-of-school numbers dramatically, while Pakistan continues to spend roughly 2.3% of its GDP on education. And as a result, it still has out-of-school numbers which are slightly reduced in comparison. So it is very clear from the evidence that we have assembled that the countries that are spending more, but not simply spending more, but perhaps also spending it wisely, are able to make much more progress in terms of reducing the number of out-of-school children. So country investment is very important. But despite the fears that the impact of the economic downturn on national education, what we are finding is that few low and middle-income countries have made cuts in their education budget. So there has been concern that with the economic downturn, countries in the middle-income countries and low-income countries will reduce their spending on education. That is not happening. We are finding that that's not happening. In fact, low-income countries increase education spending by 7.2% per year on average between 1919 and 2010. So there is some good news in that respect, that low-income countries are spending more. But I think the message here is that when the governments met in Dakar, one of the points that was made was that no country that is committed to ensuring the achievement of goals would be held back because of lack of financing. So it's important. But what we are seeing is that we have about $16 billion, which is needed in low-income countries every year to reach EFA goals, $16 billion. But let's put this in context. In 2010 alone, we spent less than $2 billion in aid towards basic education in low-income countries. So $16 billion is needed. We spend less than $2 billion. In addition, we have calculated, that is the Global Monitoring Report team has calculated, that we need about $8 billion in addition to help young people who have not completed primary school, to get into lower secondary. So the challenge is still there. More needs to be done. In 9 countries, for example, all in sub-Saharan Africa, donors fund made more than a quarter of public spending on education. For some countries, donor financing is very, very critical. If we take, for example, in Mozambique, the number of out-of-school children declined from 1.6 million in 1999 to less than 0.5 million in 2010. During this time, aid made up 42% of total education budget. So for some countries where they are getting enough aid, it is having an impact in terms of making progress towards EFA. And so aid still matters. I think that's the message that we the report puts forward. The question we asked in this year's report is whether aid has reached its peak. We've established that aid is very important if some countries, especially the poorest, are to make progress. And we were interested to see whether what is going to happen in the future, especially as we move towards 2015. Now, what we are seeing is that although progress has been made, you can see from this slide that it's been stagnating. The total amount of aid that is going to basic education 2009 to 2010 is roughly not changed. And we project that by 2015, it will actually be reducing. So aid is actually reducing. And some of the reasons are understandable, with many of the rich countries that provide the funding for support are beginning to cut back because of their own challenges they are facing in their countries. So it is having an effect. But aid is important. We need to reiterate that point, we've calculated that funding in 19 low-income countries fell quite significantly. 19 of the low-income countries, the funding fell significantly. Among them were those furthest from the EFA goals, such as Ethiopia, where the number of out-of-school children remains among the highest in the world. Aid fell from 186 to 156 million. So some of the countries that are facing the biggest challenges are also the countries that are getting receiving less support in terms of aid. And I think this is something that is worrying. This is interesting because, as you can see, in this, the point I made earlier that donors are reducing aid to poor countries. Many rich countries pledged to target 0.7% of GNI to ask for aid. And you can see not many are reaching that goal. In fact, the Netherlands, which is one of the countries that was given a lot to support education, has cut back really drastically. It's been one of the champions of funding for EFA, basic education, and it's reduced it considerably. And so that's even going to have more effect in the years to come. As you can see, Finland has reduced it just slightly, but all these rich countries are mainly reducing their aid to poor countries. One of the, maybe let me put it this way, sometimes it's, we think it's important to highlight this, that for many of these rich countries, the aid that they give actually never leaves their country. And we've tried to highlight this in this year's report. In 2010, for example, we've calculated that a quarter of direct aid to education was in the form of scholarships and stipends, student imputed cost. So a lot of this actually is money which is classified as aid for development, or for development, but actually never leaves the countries. And we have argued that if these monies are, some of this is spent on addressing the problems that the funding gap that we have raised, this will make a huge gap. And we've highlighted some of those countries. For example, in Germany, although Germany gives a lot of funding for education, it also, if you look at the top blue lines, a lot of money that it also gives, which it calls aid, actually doesn't leave the country. When I say it doesn't leave the country, it is given in terms of scholarships and imputed costs for students who come to study. So it doesn't. And our argument in the report is that some of this money, if given, of course it's important that these countries give money for this purpose, but some of this can really make a big impact on reducing on achieving the goals that we have set. Now let's take an example. In 2010, almost 40% of Japan's direct aid to education went to scholarships. 2010 alone, 40% of Japan's aid to education went to scholarships. For students studying in Japan, equivalent for Canada was 22%. To put it into perspective, we've tried to look at what this means in terms of how, if we spend some of this money to address the problem of financing. The amount it costs for one Nepalese student to study on scholarship in Japan could send as many as 229 young people to secondary school in Nepal. So just one scholarship for a student to study in Japan would give education to 229 young Nepalese students to go to secondary school. So we think that we need to begin to look at how some of this funding is done, because many of the people who get these scholarships, and I have to say, add that I'm a beneficiary of some of these scholarships, I think, and some of you may be, actually come from relatively privileged backgrounds. And if we are going to tackle some of the challenges that we're pointing at, we need to begin to pull those at the bottom to bring them up. And this is something that we've highlighted in this year's report. Again, this makes a similar point, and so I would not go on too much about it. But we want to stress again that despite the importance of aid, where national spending provides most provides funding for education, it makes a huge contribution. even though we have said that aid makes a significant contribution to low-income countries. But the fact that donors are funders of education in several countries means that aid matters. And you can see in a country like Mali, the share of aid for education is about 25%. And for many countries, this is quite significant. The aid off budget is aid that goes to NGOs, the monies that goes to NGOs and other things that are used to support education that do not go directly to the education budget. And as I've pointed out, in Mali, it's about 25% of total education spend. Now, this year's report, which I'll be moving on to the issue of skills for youth, one of the things we tried to do was to find out how much donors spend on skills development, which is the subject of the report. It's not easy to do that because, you know, skills, it's not easy to say, okay, this money is specifically for this kind of skills. We know that you can acquire skills outside school in many different contexts. So what we did was to do some few estimates, and we've classified vocational education, general education, basic life skills, and some aspects of education that is unspecified as part of skills development. And what we came up with was about $3 billion of money that goes for skills development and general budget support. So it's not it still means that there's quite a lot that it needs spending, even though quite a number of things are happening there. So to put it into in a nutshell, is to say that we are stagnating as far as the EFA goals are concerned. Funding, which was pledged by many rich countries to support achievement of these goals, is stagnating, particularly for those countries where the funding, the aid, has made a huge difference. This is worrying because it means that they may not be able to achieve the goals that they have set before them. But we also know that the countries that are spending more are beginning to make progress accordingly. And I think this is, as we move towards 2015, we need to drum up the message that more effort needs to be done. And we have put forward some suggestions to address this. Now, let me to move on to the second part of my session, to talk about skills. Before we get into the issue of skills, there are things that we need to remind ourselves of. We have, in this year, put a lot of emphasis on the skills gap for the disadvantaged. So those of you have had a look at the report. We've emphasized the young people in rural areas, in urban slums, particularly, because they are the ones who are going to face the greatest challenges when it comes to skills for work. And I think it's right that we mention it. There's a lot of talk about young people being unemployed. But quite frankly, a lot of these young people who are unemployed have skills. The problem is that the jobs are not there. Now, once the jobs come on stream, they would get the jobs. But we seem to be losing sight of a lot of other people who do not have the skills. So even when the opportunities are created, they would not be able to access jobs. And we try to put a spotlight on this. But we need to look at what the challenge is. And in this year's report, we've highlighted the fact that globally, 1 in 6 of people are between the ages of 15 to 24. So it's quite a sizable proportion of young people. In sub-Saharan Africa alone, 6 out of 10 people are below 25 years. So in sub-Saharan Africa, it's a huge youth population. And they can either become create opportunities for growth in these countries, or else they can become challenges for these countries. So it's important that their skill needs are addressed. We also expect the sub-Saharan African youth population to grow by 3.5 times larger in 2030 compared to 1980. So it's going to explode. The youth population, particularly in sub-Saharan Africa, is going to explode. We know that unemployment among young people is growing. In fact, it's about 2 to 3 times higher for young people worldwide than for adults. In the Middle East, for example, youth unemployment stands around 25%. So there are challenges that we face. What we have estimated this year, we try to find out what is the size of this problem as far as young people who lack skills. And by lack of skills, we mean young people who have not completed primary school between the ages of 15 to 24. Now, much as we've put emphasis on of children going to school, when they drop out and they become adolescents, we tend to forget about them. So we try to put a figure to find out how many are they. And we think there are about 200 million young people who haven't completed primary school. 200 million. This is roughly the equivalent of the population of Brazil. These are young people who do not have skills because they didn't complete primary school. And it's about time that we begin to say, what do they need? How can we provide them with the skills they need to have jobs? We know in poor countries, for example, one in four young people have had no choice but to take up a work in the informal sector and be paid below $1.25 a day. In Cameroon, for example, as you'll find in the report, two in three rural Cameroonians work below the poverty line. So there's a huge problem there. Much of that problem is related to the fact that these young people do not have the skills that they would have acquired if they had completed education, which raises the question about what do we do about them. This year, we try to think about pathways to skills, and you'll find this in as one of the diagrams we place a lot of emphasis on in the second part of the report. We've tried to put skills under three main areas, domains, if you like. Foundation skills, transferable skills, technical and vocational skills. And we've looked at how young people are doing with respect to these three levels. Now, the foundation skills are the most basic skills that you would expect people to acquire when they are in school. So if you take primary and lower secondary education, this is what gives children foundation skills. So if a child goes through formal education, acquires foundation skills, moves on to lower secondary, as the diagram shows, and upper secondary, then they acquire transferable and technical skills. Now, the transferable skills are those skills that allow young people to adapt and work in different work contexts. So they are the skills that deal with something like problem solving, have skills of adaptability. These are very important, and often they are acquired once they get into the secondary level. They are not things that you necessarily learn from textbooks, but they are important that young people have that if they are going to make progress. And you would expect, if the systems are working well, for young people to go through from primary to lower secondary and to upper secondary. And then once they've reached on beyond that, then they have the skills that will give them opportunity. But many of them don't. As we've said, there are 200 million young people who need a second chance because they haven't completed primary school or have not had opportunity to go to secondary. And we think that we need to begin to think, how do we offer them this second chance? Our analysis is showing that there are about 61 million children and 71 million adolescents who are out of school. Many of these people are in the 200 million bracket. And so it's important. For example, if you look at countries like Burkina Faso, Mali, and Niger, three in every five young person has never been to school by the time they reach the ages between 15 to 19. Three in every five. Now, that's about 60% of young people haven't been to school. Now, the question that we have posed in this year's report, these young people need a second chance. Without a second chance, they would not be able to take advantage of any opportunities that will be created. And here I'll put myself in. I think for those of us, many of us from Africa, where often Africa is being presented as a country where new opportunities are coming on board, economies are growing, many of these young people would not benefit from these opportunities because they don't even have the basic skills to progress. So if you look in the report, this is something that we've used to explain what is going on in many of these countries We also try to look at how many second chance programs are there. Okay, we are saying 200 million young people need a second chance. But what is the scale of the challenge? And you would find that, you know, we took seven countries which has the largest second chance programs that we could find. And already in those countries, they are reaching only a sixth of the young people for those programs that they are offering for second as a second chance. Only a sixth of young people are being reached. And so it is it's a big problem. It's a big gap that needs to be addressed. We have argued that we need to focus a lot on the alternative routes to provide them with a chance to acquire skills. We've argued in the report that skills pays. Actually, we calculated in one of our analyses that for every $1 invested in a child's education, the skill pays back a tenfold in terms of economic growth in that person's life. And we've used the example of Ghana and Korea to explain this important fact, that if you look at Ghana and Korea, which had similar secondary gross enrollment rates in the early 1970s, but immediately had two different trajectories as far as investment in education is concerned. By the mid-1990s, Korea had already achieved universal secondary education. A lot of investment in primary, achieving universal primary, and then went on to achieve universal secondary. Whereas Ghana has struggled, it's only beginning to make progress. And we think that there is some relationship with that if you look at it also in terms of economic growth, which has completely, you know, has two trajectories if you look at these two countries. One of the things we are finding out, of course, it's not simply providing skills. If you have skills, you have to have jobs. One of the interesting things about Korea is that when they invested in skilling up the whole country, in skilling up all our young people, they put also a lot of investment in small businesses to create jobs that would make the demand, would make the supply of skills meet the demand that was being created. So it was not simply investment in skills, but also a lot of effort into creating, supporting small-scale businesses and medium enterprises to invest in the future technologies that will require these skills. So we think it's important that we understand that skills really makes a difference in the way countries develop. And countries that have had good plans are able to harness the benefits of skills development. We did find in our analysis that in 46 developing countries, when we looked at their plans, education sector plans, their policy plans, very few of them recognize the importance of training in the informal sector. In many countries in the developing world, it is the informal sector that is growing, that is expanding. And yet, not many are emphasizing the importance of supporting the informal sector so that they will provide the kind of jobs that will be needed for young people. Now, as I come to some of the concluding parts of my presentation, I want to highlight a couple of things. If you take a country like Ethiopia, you find that those without education, young people without education between the ages of 15 and 19, from this graph about roughly 40%, those who drop out before completing about another maybe 10 or something percent, and then those who have gone up to the primary. So up to about 70%. So even though Ethiopia is one of the fastest growing economies in Africa, and probably in the world, it has a huge number of young people who do not have skills who benefit from this growth. And this is something that is portrayed in many countries. We've seen that over half of young Ethiopians, for example, have either dropped out of primary school or haven't had any education at all, as you can see here. And these people need a second chance, as we make very clear. In effect, about three quarters have less than a secondary education in Ethiopia, and leaving many of them without the foundations, the skills they need to get a job And in the report, we've done this for many countries, and you can see that as you move down this graph and you come to sub-Saharan African countries, the problem becomes much more acute. If you're in the blue margins are the ones where at least young people have completed secondary, so have had the benefit of acquiring foundation skills and transferable skills, and therefore have the potential to get jobs once the opportunities come. We find that 30 out of 59 countries have more than half of the youth who lack foundation skills. Now, let me just move on in the last stages of my slides to talk about the issue about urban poverty. We know that urban poverty is reducing the chances of acquiring skills. For example, in some of the urban poorest, the disadvantage is worse than the rural, which is interesting because we tend to think that it's only in the rural areas where the disadvantage is. But we are finding that in some of the urban poorer people, they actually suffer more disadvantage than those in the rural areas. And Cambodia is an example that we have used to highlight this. You would see that in the rural poorest, 40%, rural poorest were 40%, about 90% as compared to 82% for the urban poorest. This changes for other countries. In other places too, you find that it is the rural poorest who are very disadvantaged. In Nigeria, as the slide here shows, about 57% of the poorest in urban areas lack foundation skills, compared to 7% in urban rich. So this is a problem that is it's everywhere. I've talked a lot about low-income countries, middle-income countries, but the problem is also acute in Europe, where a lot of those without foundation skills have suffered as a result of the economic downturn. If you look at the data in Europe, you find that those who have suffered in terms of unemployment are those with less than foundation or who do not have foundation skills. If you look in the case of Finland, for example, those without foundation skills from, if you compare 2007 to 2009, they have had, their rate of unemployment has gone up. So without foundation skills in developed countries, you are even worse off. And the recession, the economic downturn has hit those young people who do not have these skills. So even though we are talking about a lot of young people without jobs, often the problem is even more acute for those without skills. It's worse, and I think we need to highlight that. Similar situation if you're a poor, a rural young woman. I think the evidence clearly shows that women are at a disadvantage than men. But there are cases where men are at a disadvantage. I think we need to be able to look at why that is happening. In some countries, in Brazil, for example, if you're a man, you're at a disadvantage as far as foundation skills are concerned in rural context. So to conclude, we have, in this year's report, looked at some of the examples of positive things that are going on. I think it's easy to see that, well, the future doesn't look bright. There are challenges wherever you look at. But we've highlighted in the report many examples which point to the fact that if the right things are done, a lot of progress can be made. So, for example, we've come up with some recommendations. First, it is important that countries remove the barriers to secondary education. And, for example, in Rwanda, when they introduced a 9-year cycle of and eliminated fees for lower secondary, it boosted enrollment by 27% in a single year. So removing the barriers which prevent many young people from getting access to secondary is important. Another point that we've tried to highlight in the report is to make secondary school relevant to the world of work. A lot of young people who do not progress beyond the secondary level have to find work. Often they find that they have not been given the skills that allows them, enables them to find work. And we've looked at examples of countries where when young people are in secondary, they have opportunity to pick up skills as they have their secondary education. Those young people tend to have, when they get onto the job market, have better opportunities than those who haven't. And Germany is a good example. We also think that we have to provide alternative routes to early school leavers. When young people leave school for one reason or the other, in many countries, they cannot get back because the systems are set up in such a way that you have to go through certain formal qualifications, some formal processes to be able to acquire skills. And I think it's important that we look at flexible ways for young people who have exited the school system to acquire skills. And Philippines, we've highlighted as one which has a distance learning program which has managed to reduce a dropout from, say, 13% to 8% over 5 years. We also emphasize the importance of targeting the unemployed youth in policies and programs. And we have examples to illustrate that. Supporting traditional apprenticeships in many countries. Surprisingly, in many countries where there are traditional apprenticeships, the poor are less likely to have access to them. In Ghana, for example, many of the traditional apprenticeships, the poorest have problem accessing them. A lot of our evidence suggests that if you are in the second half of the income bracket, quarter, you are more likely to get access to apprenticeship. We've highlighted the importance of making foundation skills part of entrepreneurial skills training, something which is also important to offer young people an opportunity. We've highlighted the importance of providing second chance programs. This is something I've repeated a couple of times. And also combining skills training with assets. There are a lot of programs which provide assets to help young women, especially in rural areas, to make a better living, actually do much more good if it's accompanied with skills training. So we think that should be emphasized. For one of the things we also seen is for a lot of young women who are in rural areas because of family setups and cultural practices, they cannot even leave their homes to attend training. It's very difficult for these women to access any kind of training that is provided. I think we've been able to find programs where they are using technology to reach these young women and provide them with skills. There are good examples of using the mobile phone to give information to young mothers who are into farming, to give them the latest information about farming, etc. So we think these are important. Finally, the report comes out with 10 things that need to be done. Provide second chance education to those who do not have it. Remove the barriers limiting access to secondary. Improve the relevance of upper secondary school education to work. Provide access to skills training. Aim policies and programs in deprived areas. Link skills training with social protection. And also prioritize training for disadvantaged, especially young women. And I've mentioned the issue about technology, strengthening the data collection. A lot of countries do not have good data on the skills needs. And we think that it's important that the database for that is very important, needs to be gathered. And then we have also made some recommendations for the private sector and also for what young people can do. This year, we've had a new approach. We've actually got some young people to rewrite the report in their own words and how they will represent it. And that has been done. I think it will be launched next week. So we got a group of young people to say, okay, how would you like to tell this story from this report in your own words? And I think this will be up on the website soon, so you can have access to how young people have reinterpreted the messages that we have in this year's report. And on that note, I want to thank you all very much for your attention. Thank you.
Professor Ak Jempong, thank you very much for those statistics and your nice explanations and for your wonderful slides. We will have time discussions a little later, but I would now like to open the door for some few comments or questions for Professor Ak Jempong. So feel free. The case is open for a while. For questions? No. Oh, okay. Abebe. Just a minute, you will get the microphone.
My voice is very loud. Don't worry.
But the people in the net won't hear you.
Okay. By the way, Doctor, I am very happy to hear a very good news of the progress, particularly in tropical Africa. But my worry is that how far it is true. Because I know that there are countries who are excellent architects in producing, you know, a very colorful, you know, progress activity progress reports. So my question to UNESCO is that, what is your mechanism to prove that, you know, data or the report gathered from the countries is based on reliable information? Because I know that these countries would produce, you know, a sort of, you know, activity progress report in order to secure financial aid and support from funding agencies. So do you have a mechanism to prove the reality on the ground, or simply you use, you know, the reports coming from the governments? This is the first question. And the second one is, I wonder, you know, the UN athletes, including UNESCO and others, always overcrowd the issue of students with special needs education under the category of disadvantage. I could not understand why the issue of special educational needs is, you know, overcrowded under this vast category. Girls are disadvantaged. You know, street children, orphans are disadvantaged. But all these sections of society, problem is not similar to the challenges of children with disabilities. Why don't you have, you know, a very separate, you know, section in your report or program to about special educational needs? Thank you.
Thank you. Professor
Akjempong. Thank you very much. I think these are very important questions. The issue about data is very important, because the data we put out there, it needs to be, as far as possible, very accurate. And so what we do is that we do not ask the governments to give us the data. The data that we use often comes from the UIS, the UNESCO Institute of Statistics, and they have mechanisms in place to cross-check when this data comes to them. So there are times where we do not even use country data when we are not confident about it. So this year, I don't want to name the countries, but about three or four countries, we did not use the data, because our quality checks raise questions about the data. And so we said, well, if we're not sure about the data, then it's better not to use it, because if you use it and then you find that there are issues around it, then there are problems. But this data is actually supplied to the UNESCO Institute of Statistics, and we in collaboration with them, analyze the data. If we have issues about the data, we go back and check, and sometimes we get governments are coming back to us and say, we're not sure about this data, and we're able to tell them, this is the data that you have provided, and so maybe you need to look at that. But I can assure you that there's a very serious effort made to make sure that this data is accurate, and that is something we take very, very, very seriously. Maybe later on I can tell you about the process we go through to do that. Special education is very important. In fact, this year we have something which I agree we should give it more attention than we do. Unfortunately, we don't do enough of that. But we have given it a little space in this year's report. One of the problems we have is that it's the data on special education, often in many of these countries, is very patchy. You know, we're not getting we don't want to use data that is questionable. So sometimes we get data and the way in which the data has been collected is questionable. And so when you start putting these in your analysis and putting figures out, it becomes a problem. So we were able to use a few cases, I think it's one or two country cases, that we were quite sure that data was a bit sound. But I agree that it is very important that is given attention, and perhaps we are not doing enough of that. But it's something that we intend to keep the focus on in subsequent reports that will come out.
Thank you, Professor Akjempong. And before we continue discussion, I will now give the floor for the comment speech by Ms. Henny Axelin, who comes from the Ministry of Education and Culture. And thank you, Professor Akcempong. We come maybe later also for these questions. And Ms. Henny Axelin, she's coming from the Department of Higher Education and Science Policy in our ministry, and to be more precise, from the Science Policy Division. And her expertise areas are sustainable development and Arctic regions. Henny, you're welcome.
Thank you. I just ask him also to stay here, because I hope we will have a long and vivid discussion after a few words that I have to say. But first of all, thank you for inviting me to have this comment speech here, and thank you for the good presentation that we just heard. And also especially thank for this important and topical report. I think that during these 2 days we've heard success stories, and we've heard many challenges that there still are on the global education agenda. And we just heard how there are big problems when it comes to primary education and when it comes to adult illiteracy, that we have 700 million adults who still cannot read or write in the world, and problems like that. But despite these facts, I still do believe that that education for all, it has been a success. It has, together with the Education First initiative, it has brought education to UN global policy agendas, and that is very important. And monitoring reports such as this one, they do have a key role in bringing the evidence-based policy into our society. It is a tool for decision makers to know what decisions they are making, and making sure that the decisions are based on research, based on data, and real evidence. We all know that development and education are of course interlinked. There is no development, and at least there is no sustainable development without quality education. And this year's report is of special significance that it focuses on youth and youth. It is, of course, important for the reason that it is one of the goals that has been least analyzed so far. But it is also very important, as we heard, there are huge generations of young people in the world, especially in sub-Saharan Africa. And at the same time, a large percentage of these young people are unemployed, or they lack the skills to be employed. And at the same time, of course, as we all know, there is economic crisis going around the world. And to combine these two things, that we have huge generations without skills or employ, and then we have economic crisis, it is not sustainable, and education is one key solution for making this more sustainable. And primary education, as we then know, is not alone enough. We also need to invest in secondary or in vocational education. It is the tool to global society and economy. And if we do focus on pre and primary education and invest in secondary and vocational education, we must not forget the higher education. And I'm not saying just because I come from the higher education department, but it's also essential that we understand that higher education brings then, along with the research and innovations, it brings us also jobs. And if we have millions of people, young people who need education, they also need jobs. And as a Finn, I'm of course very proud of our school system. We do very well in the PISA tests, and often it is said to be the one of the best school systems in the world. But of course, it is not a perfect system. We know that over 90% of the Finns go through 9 years of basic education. But after the basic education, 9 years, it is harder and harder to get a job in Finland if you do not have any vocational training or do not go in to the higher secondary education or to higher education and have a degree. Those jobs are very few in Finland these days. And the numbers are big. They say that there are 40,000 young people in Finland who do not have anything else than this 9 years of primary education. They don't have study places, or they don't have a job or a training. And One solution for this, what the government is launching next year, would be youth guarantee. I don't know if you know what a youth guarantee in Finland will be, but it means that after 3 months, when someone under 30 becomes unemployed or gets kicked out of school or finishes the school but without a vocational degree or higher education degree, they will be guaranteed a place in some institution for studying or for a training or a job place. 3 months, everyone. And path to sustainable society and future, it naturally goes through sustainable education. We must also ensure that all education that we give in all levels in our schools is sustainable. And sustainability in here, I mean, we have three aspects of sustainability. We should teach our children what is economically sustainable society. It means, for example, for kids to know what does responsible consuming mean. Or then we have to teach them about ecological sustainability. They need to learn in school about nature values and how to preserve those. And they also must learn about the importance of their cultural heritage and then about the social aspects of sustainability, about education and work and how to not teach your, tease your friends or anything like that, but and also the cultural heritage. We've already heard today, UNESCO's Decade for Sustainable Education is going on from 2005 to 2014. We still have 2 years, or a bit more, but 2 years. 2 years to reach quite ambitious goals that we've set for ourselves. And as most countries, also Finland has two ESD strategies. And we just recently had an assessment about the strategies and how are we doing achieving our goals. The results were not just positive. There is still loads of work to do. And Finnish University Partnership for International Development, UNIPID, I think it's most for you, it's probably well-known organization. It supports Finnish universities in promotion and implementation of sustainable development and also international development. And just last Monday, Ministry of Education and Culture admitted €1 million to enhance the international cooperation of the Finnish science and research community towards Africa, Latin America, and Caribbean. And I hope this will also enhance the global responsibility. Thank you. And one last thing is the year 2015, because we have many deadlines in 2015, and I just want to raise the question up that do we realize that it is so close? There are only a few years, and we have Millennium Development Goals, we have the Education for All Goals, then we have the UNESCO Decade for Sustainable Education that will come to end before that. And I just want to emphasize that it is the entire world education community's responsibility, and it is the responsibility of us all here also to make sure that the education is high on all these discussion agendas also after 2015. As the challenges are so global and big, we have to take and bear them as a global society too. Thank you, but
Thank you very much, Henny. And would you also like to stay here, maybe for the comments and questions that you might also address? So now I open the floor for the real comments and questions, and now you will have more time. So let's start. Who would be the first one? Get the microphone. It's here in front.
Thank you, Dr. Champong, for an excellent presentation. I remember reading the report hurriedly when I was preparing to come for this seminar. I'm trying to recall if I found any section that talked about or where you analyzed the link between good governance and and the progress in achieving the EFA goals. Because in my mind, a lot hinges on that, especially for developing countries, at least you know, small states and so on. So can you refresh me if there was a section on the link between governance and progress? And if not, why not? And whether you shouldn't do that.
Thank you very much. A short answer. It's not a particular focus in this report. Actually, I think 2009 or so, a whole report was devoted to this. So this is an issue which is so important that we previously devoted a full report on the issue of governance and achievement of EFA goals. And we've made that same point in that report that governance matters very much. In fact, it is so important fundamentally in helping to address these challenges. So you wouldn't find that it directly mentioned or directly referenced in the way you've put it. But it is implied in some of the arguments that we've made in the report that, for example, in the countries where they have taken up the mantle, the challenge to address the problems, resources that have come from internally and have used to tackle the problems of access to education, they have made more progress. So the issue of governance is fundamental. It's so important. We do show in the report that, in fact, in some countries, if they divest a little bit of their funding that is coming from oil, fortunately Ghana is one of those countries that's bidding to get money from oil. If some of this funding goes into education, and the leadership makes the right choices and decisions with respect to that, that can make a huge impact. In the report, we talk about Chad, that it's not doing enough, but Chad has a lot of resources. And if it put a little bit of that into that, addressing the problems of education, it will leverage a lot of change. So I think that the issue about governance is important, and we have recognized in a previous report, and I think a lot of this is also implied in what we've said in this year's report.
I'm very uncomfortable that you put the onus on donor. I'm very uncomfortable that you should put so much weight on aid and on, you know, how aid could help to improve the situation. Mm. I'm very uncomfortable with that. I think you should rather have put onus on national governments and, you know, and individuals. For me, it's a wrong signal.
Okay.
That you should be putting, you know, a whole a burden, or you should be dreaming that aid could, you know, make a difference.
I think that maybe the way I presented it is because in the report, one of the things we mentioned is that the first initiative, the first emphasis has to come from government. And we do show in the analysis that the governments that have put more money into education have leveraged a lot of impact. But however, there are countries where we show that without the aid that they have received, they would have made far less progress than they have made. So it's a double-edged sword. We are not saying that the country should rely exclusively on aid. Aid matters, but it has to be used in a way which addresses the needs of the disadvantaged. Secondly, we've shown in the report that actually, if countries can leverage more of their resources, they will achieve much more than the aid which is given. And a lot of the education budget in many developing countries is not actually aid money. It's a small percentage of the funding that goes into education. Governments actually spend more, okay? And so I think the message is not, I'm sorry if that's hard, but the message is not that aid is the solution. What we are saying, that aid is important. And for some countries that are further behind, they may need extra support because of the 2015 target. But other countries, many other countries, they have the resources. I think this is what we are pointing out, to actually invest in education. And if they do, they can leverage a lot of positive gains. And that message is also very strongly made in the report.
Thank you. The next question will be for Mr. Jussi Karakoski from the Ministry for Foreign Affairs, and then
Thank you very much, Dr. Akwampong, for a wonderful report and wonderful presentation. I have one comment and one question to you. The first is a comment on the aid figures and statistics that you showed. I told a different narrative about Finnish aid yesterday, so I want this clarification, which is, I think it's more relevant for our discussion what the aid to education is than overall aid that you showed in your slide. So that was overall aid as share of GNI. So absolutely correct figures, but I think still Finnish overall aid has increased from 2010 to 2011, and also aid to education has increased in absolute terms, both in commitments and disbursements, and also aid to education has increased in relative terms as a share of aid. So that would be perhaps more accurate or relevant for our discussion if those figures for all aid agencies would be given instead of overall aid to all sectors. The question concerns, I also want to echo Dr. Abebe's question. We have had a lot of discussion and comments from the audience, and some have given their comments on paper, which you can see there. And many of those questions somehow relate to equity issues or inclusive education issues or both. And I was looking at your recommendations and looking what their relevance might be for disadvantaged learners and, for instance, for disabled learners who never entered school or drop out early in their school career with little skills learned in school. And I found very little in there. And I'm asking this because of the urgency and also echoing what Henny Axelin from the Ministry of Education and Culture was saying, that in 2 weeks' time, the UNESCO convened EFA Global Education Meeting, high-level meeting will take place in Paris and focus on the big push needed by 2015. And I would just want to encourage you to repackage some of your messages to be more relevant for that discussion. I'm sure you'll do it, but I think there are many issues because you focused on this year's theme so much, which are perhaps not the most relevant for that discussion. So I know the International Committee places too high expectations for you, but because of the real importance of the report for the global community, that's very important that the messages at this particular point will be focused on what needs to be done by 2015. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I thank you for bringing the point about Finnish aid. Actually, in the report, you would find that we have actually said what you've said in the report, that Finland is a very positive thing. The slide I showed was just like you said, overall aid, but I think there are countries that are doing very well in doing that, and we've highlighted that. Unfortunately, in a presentation like this, you can't, sometimes you pick certain. The issue about next year's about equity is very important. And again, we have devoted next year's report solely for that because we want to influence the debate around the post-2015 agenda. So all the work that we're doing for next year's report is actually to address the issue that you have raised. And we are hoping that come September, when some of the discussions will be coming together, our report will be ready to inform the debate and discussions about what we should do next in 2015. So what I'm saying is that we have taken this on board, and some of what they're saying in this report really shows time about these issues we are thinking in the we'll take the
thank you. And then here and there first.
Thank you both for the presentation. My first point is just a comment about the aid. And I think that we must also tell the donor agencies to also do much to monitor what the aid they send to some of this country, what the aid is being used for. It's very important because of corruption and all that. And my second point is that I think in the report somewhere it was stated that the percentage of secondary school pupils attending vocational or technical education is around 11%. And this figure has remained there for very long time. And my question is, I think yesterday we had a presentation about skills in Finland, and I realized that a large number of secondary school students are entering. They are interested in vocational education, which is another important stream when it comes to skills development. And I pose a question, how can we make this stream, vocational education or technical education, attractive for the youth? Because, in Africa, it's not that attractive stream for young people to go. So I want to find out. I got some questions, some answers yesterday about what the government of Finland is doing to make this attractive. But if you can, I was not satisfied on some of the questions that were answers that were given. If you can tell us more, what is the Finnish government doing to make, it is going on, making the vocational sector attractive for the young people? And in Africa, how can we make it that attractive for the young people to enter? Okay, thank you.
Okay, thank you. So,
vocational education. Doing the report show how countries that provide that, but provide that in very innovative ways, are able to get more young people attracted to it. I think you'll find that in Africa, in some low-income countries, the provision of vocational and technical education is very poor quality. It's the facilities, the investment into that sector is very minimal. So in itself, it reinforces this idea that it's a second best option. I think much more resources and much more needs to go into make it much more attractive. But also, it has to also do with the demand side of the training. If there is much more demand for skills that require this in the economy, I think you'll find that young people would be attracted to it, because if they have a vocational qualification, there are jobs out there for them to do. So I think it needs something, a very comprehensive approach to it. In the report, we highlight how some countries which have provided vocational secondary education actually have provided in such a way that if you are in a rural area, you get a second, not a very good vocational education. So I think that it's important that if vocational technical education is provided, it is provided in such a way that it is not a second best. And if you don't get it a second best when you're in a rural area or when you're in some other part of the country, I think this is a message that needs to be reinforced. Unfortunately, a lot of governments make noise about vocational technical education, but they don't put enough resources into it. And I think this is where the problem is.
Okay, and then Henny for finish.
Yes. Just maybe shortly to your question about how do we do that in Finland. I must first say that I'm not the best expert that the minister has on vocational education. But what I do know is that what interests young people is the connections to work life. If they have, of course, the quality of education must be good, but they also have quite a lot of links with the actual workplaces that you might get a trainee place then later, or get a job actually later. And for that reason, to go into a vocational training or a technical training might mean that you have more guaranteed job after you graduate than if you go to University of Applied Sciences and those degrees. It might be harder to get a job in Finland. And also another thing, as I said, there are fewer and fewer jobs in Finland that you can do without no education or technical. So it's encouraging young people to get some sort of training after the basic education, because you know that there are fewer jobs that you can do just based on that you can read and write and do some maths. So professional in any job.
Thank you. And then here on the right side, and then back.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Dr. Kvane, for a very informative presentation. A lot of learning experiences going on here. I wanted to ask about the sustainable development and connection to the global monitoring reporting, because when listening to these different campaigns, different decades for UN Health, EFA, MDGs, and then this decade for education for sustainable development. So is there any connection, and then was there any discussion when preparing this monitoring report about this decade for sustainable development, how it would be, let's say, visible or somehow connected to vocational education? And then I have also a short question to Henni. You mentioned that Finland has still a lot to do with this decade for education for sustainable development. So what are the plans? How are you planning to continue the work during the last 2 years? Thank you.
Thank you. And Professor Akjembo.
Okay. We haven't in the report placed a special emphasis on that relationship, but I think if you read the chapter on rural, on skills for rural young people, we do make the point that one of the challenges that would face the next generation of young people is how they can survive in environments where the resources are being degraded. There are more challenges in the environment in which they live, which requires that they have skills to address them. There are fewer lands for people to farm on, for young people, families to farm on. There are challenges of the degradation of the environment in those communities which they live. Now, this requires that they are actually given the kind of skills to be able to manage their environments well. And we have emphasized that as an important area in terms of skills development. So I think we mentioned that we do say that this is very, very important so that you don't get a situation where you have particularly young people in rural areas that even when they have skills, they cannot survive in the environment in which they live. So that is given a mention in the report.
Thank you. And Ms. Henni?
Yeah. About the ESD strategies, we have the fortunate and unfortunate thing that the strategies are so ambitious that it is already clear that we will have something to do after 2014 also with those same goals. And in our assessment, what I mentioned, it became very clear that we should not do new strategies after 2014, but we should continue implementing these, because the mechanisms that we are implementing them with, some of them are long strategy plans or lines that are already locked till 2016, for example, and the next round that we are going to be able to work with those is coming after 2014. But for example, we will have to work more closely with local cities to be able to influence what do the children in school learn, because we have like national strategy lines, but then of course what the communities do, it's up to them, so we have to work together with them. That's one thing, for example, and then maybe enhance some cooperation also with universities and universities of applied sciences to ensure the quality of sustainable education also here.
Then we go to back.
Thank you. I am Mikko Kanto with Plan International in Finland. I'd first like to thank for the whole EFA Global Monitoring Report team for a very rich report. I think it's one where there are several take-home messages that I believe each of us can find in the report. And to me, there are two. One is the magnitude of the challenges for the world's youth today, and the urgency, and the other is the outrageous ignored commitment made in 2000 and forgotten. And that leads me to agree strongly with Ms. Axelin on the joint commitment to work on the challenges highlighted in the report, and also to make a remark related to the previous comment regarding the wrong signal that you might interpret this to mean. I think the wrong signal here is that we are internationally committed and we are not delivering, and we are actually impeding progress by holding back resources that are rightfully belong to those countries who are making progress and showing actual commitment. And also related to the discussion on Finnish numbers, and it's great that Jussi Karagoski is entering the room right now, I would just point out that we are actually in education and development cooperation exiting the absolute low point in terms of our commitment in numbers to the education sector, and it's great that we are improving in terms of relative numbers, in terms of absolute numbers. We as an organization are advocating for more. We have a Right to Learn campaign right now advocating for 10% of development cooperation funds to be allocated to education. Reading and hearing about the report, I think that's going to be a modest ask to the government, and we should perhaps be asking for more. And that I'm very happy to see the solid evidence base in the report. I would also say, and this is a question, Dr. Kwame, to you, regarding terminology. I know that dropout is an established term, and it's easily understandable. But I would ask the report team to consider reversing the use of dropout to a better term, in my view, which would be pushout, because in most cases, it's not the child actively dropping out of school. It's the system pushing out children from education, because it's not delivering to the needs of the child. It's not delivering quality education. The pedagogical approaches are sometimes outright hostile to the child. They are not conducive to learning. The contents might not be relevant to the communities. The instruction might be given in a completely inappropriate language. And these, to me, are factors pushing the child out rather than the child dropping out of a good educational system. So that's a question. I know it's controversial, but at least it's food for thought. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Well, the audience seems to like your suggestion. What about you, Dr. Pompe?
Yes, I totally agree. I mean, the terminology dropout has been, you know, this is not the first time we're using it. It's used in a context where people, both for our analysis and where people understand roughly what we mean by that. But what you're talking about is really the causes, what really allows let's happen. You talked about the push, but there are pull factors also. Maybe allow me, I'll introduce the pull, because sometimes it's not the schools pushing, but it's what is happening out in society, pulling children out of school. And we have a lot of evidence in many countries that there are factors outside the school system which is making it difficult for children to stay in education. There are push and pull factors. So I agree with you that this is something that is important. And I think you'll find that we talk about that as some of the underlying factors which are affecting the drop that needs to be addressed.
Thank you. And Professor Rauni, did you want to comment this?
Okay, when we start talking about the terms, maybe second chance is another term that could be discussed. Whether we could suggest something like alternative paths or something more positive, not indicating that you have lost already one. Now you maybe have another one.
Like fresh start. How about that?
Okay, yeah, I think it would be probably a better term. We do actually, when you begin to break it down in terms of opportunity, we talk about alternative approaches, alternative opportunities. So there are different terminologies that we can use. We did use the second chance, and I know that sometimes it connotes a negative meaning because of the fact that, you know, the person has lost the first chance. So I think we have debated that, and maybe there are better ways to represent. For our purposes, the use of second chance actually fits to present what we want to say.
Mm-hmm. And being second is not that bad, after all, if you can't be the first. So here we go, and then on the left here we had one, and then you.
All right. It's a little bit related, actually, to a few things that have been said today. I'm an immigrant to Finland, and I have a child. My child is 21 years old now. There's two things that I actually would like to talk about, and one was the early childhood education that's in the report. When I moved to Finland, I decided she needed to learn Finnish. She was 4 years old, and I did put her in daycare. But if it wasn't for the fact that we needed language, we needed her to learn the language, I might not have actually put her in daycare, because in some ways I feel like education at home is also quite important. And I think in many cultures, I know there's some families in every culture that are maybe not nurturing to their children, but I think in every culture there are families who are nurturing to their own children. And I'm not 100% sure that early childhood education is the answer for everybody. I could be wrong. The second thing that really hit me when I moved back to Finland for a second time so that my child would have more of her education here was that in my home country, I probably would have pushed my child more to go to university and get a proper degree. And here in Finland, I encouraged my child not to do that, actually, to go for vocational training, because when she got to that age, actually, she didn't know what she wanted to do, where she wanted to go. She had certain talents that may be more useful for her in the vocational area. But I know that someday, if she decides that she wants that university degree, she can go back to university. In my home country, it costs quite a lot, actually, to get whatever education beyond high school that you would get, and I would have encouraged her for sure to go all the way to get her university degree. So having free education beyond high school, I think, is at least has been very important in my family. I found the report because they talked about early education, and they're printing figures about the number of children who enter early education facilities as something important. I'd like to address why that is important. And I'd also wonder how we can actually educate parents I guess the reason why I encourage my child to go into vocational training is because education is free, and I know that she can change her mind later. There's opportunities here in Finland to re-educate. Is the report actually talking very much about people changing their mind? I know you're talking about the second chances, but you're really talking about the primary education in the second chances, not so much switching from the vocational to higher education later on. But maybe there is something in here that I haven't seen yet. Thank you.
Thank you.
I'll address the point you just one of the points we make in the report is the importance of having flexibility. But some of the evidence we reviewed in countries where young people have had vocational education, actually their opportunities have narrowed. One, because the demand for the kind of vocational education is not there. Also, sometimes young people change their minds. So if they decide, okay, I wanted to go and do a vocational, I've started, I've finished. Actually, now I want to go and do something else, and to go into university or something like that. They find that they cannot trade what they have acquired vocationally to something else. So in many countries, dead end. And this is where it becomes a problem. And the important is to have the flexibility for students to be able to mix and match what they think require they need. But also that there's the demand for those skills must be there. And I, the same way, if I'm in a situation where I think my child will have opportunity by doing a vocational education, I think the child and the parent would encourage that. But I think in many countries, especially in the poor countries where they are pushing for vocational education, it's a lot of rhetoric. The investment and the support for people who would have a vocational education to acquire, to have jobs, is not even there. And so with time, parents begin to realize that actually vocational education, jobs that were promised. And I think much more needs to be done to ensure that those skills that are provided actually lead to opportunities that are out there. And that is why in the report we say that the informal sector, in fact for many poor countries or low-income countries, the informal sector employs a lot more people than the formal sector, and is going to continue to do that in the foreseeable future. And yet there's very little investment into that sector to open up the opportunities and to invest in those areas so that there will be jobs, opportunities for them to have this book. I think it's the issue about the early childhood. I think you have a point, but you would find that in the evidence that we look at, that I think it's fairly safe to say that for many children who have had an early childhood care, tend to have a head start than children who don't. And in many poor countries, the difference between actually making progress is down to what you get as an early start in that form. Of course, when societies develop and there's more equitable distribution of wealth, much more of that can be also provided in the home setting, in the environment, which is already happening. And we are not diminishing the importance that the home and the society plays, but I think there's a contribution that the childhood education makes to help the child to make.
Thank you. And then we have a question there back.
So, thank you very much. On behalf of the Ministry of Education and Culture, for coming here and having this truly wonderful representation, and also thanking of this lovely discussion. What I would like to first question relating to the figures, because this year's report claims that the number of the out-of-school children has stagnated to 61 million. But I was only wondering, because the report from last year speaks of a number of 67 million children out of school. And this refers to the year 2008. And this stagnation, on the other hand, refers to years between 2008 and 2010. So that was actually a question. Then another question referring to the indicators, because I understand that most of the material used in the report, in writing the report, is based on the high quality work of the UNESCO Institute of Statistics in Montreal. And I believe there's quite a lot of discussion. There's no debate on the issue of the importance of the quality of education. So therefore, this is all basically quantitative data. So are there perhaps some plans or some discussions going on referring to how to develop more qualitative indicators in the monitoring of the EFAP process? And my final point would be actually more like a comment. instead of a question. And I would come back to this post-2015 theme. And I must say that I have to back up my colleague from the sister Ministry for Foreign Affairs, Mr. Karakoski, who commented that there truly is a high-level meeting next week coming in Paris, and it would be of utmost importance of already starting slowly to having a true debate on what is going to happen to EFA agenda after 2015. There are other processes, as we must all know, going on currently. A year from now, we already have United Nations General Assembly discussion, debates behind us concerning the launch of the high-level panel of the post-MDG set by the UN Secretary General. What will be there in those proposals? Maybe education should be, of course, I believe, and we all must do our own part to ensure that education will be included there. The other question is, will that be enough? And I just refer that there's also in the UNESCO framework, there's some work going on or has been done relating to the post-2015, and I go back to the May this year in Bangkok, there was a regional high-level conference on EFA post-2015. And in those recommendations, there's quite a strictly expressed view that there should be a specific education agenda after 2015. So I believe that our wish, our hope, our regards will go in the direction that shall only MDG post-2015 be enough, or should we truly, seriously start the debate on EFA 2015 post? Thank you.
Thank you for those questions, more comments, so, more, and Professor Kwam.
Yeah, very, very quick comments. I do share the issue post-2015. How education has to be part of that. I know that there are a lot of processes and discussions going on. UNESCO itself is engaging in that debate, and a lot is going on. I think this is the point I made earlier on that already I think one of the things we are seeing as the Global Monitoring Report team is that unless we really marshal the evidence and the arguments why education, any kind of crucial, we risk that this becomes something that is not given the priority that it deserves. That is why I said at the beginning that actually the 2013 report is devoted to this argument. It's a report that will have three parts. One part would look at the progress that is being made. The two other parts would focus on how much education has contributed to the progress that the world has made in almost every department of development, and to make the case that education has to be at the center of how we define the next goals or whatever goals that will be coming forward. So we hope that this report will come on stream when the arguments and the debates and the decisions are coming together, so that as an education community we would have something to stand on. Because I think when you're talking to people who are not in education, who have other priorities, you need to say a bit more about why education, for you and I, it may be obvious, but where they are competing demands, people may not prioritize education as issues. So I think I do share your concern, and I think it's something that we are taking on board very seriously. Quickly, you talked about qualitative indicators. We focused on quantitative because of the way in which the goals have been expressed and the way to try to measure them. But we do take qualitative issues as you read the report as part of the important evidence. But I think we are led by the way in which these frame. We do not only use UI's data, we do a lot of analysis ourselves. We have teams who do that. We use a lot of household survey data. We commission a lot of other
So we kind of try and use other sources of data. On the stagnation issue, I think it's something that maybe we can discuss. The way in which we are interpreting the fact that it's stagnating is the projections that were made, but where we should be by now, if we were making the progress, the rate at which it was started, it does appear that progress is really slowed down, and the figures are not encouraging. And like I said, using Nigeria as an example, it's one of the countries that contributes a lot to the out-of-school population. So once that is going up, it's an issue for concern. And I think there are issues around why that has created the problem that we have. But I'm happy to discuss that.
Thank you. Okay, here and in front we have Pantahun from Ethiopia.
Okay, I was just hesitating whether to speak or not, but in the end I decided just to say something, especially Ethiopia was mentioned in this presentation almost four times, and three were actually for the bad, and one as a good, as the fast growing economy, but I'm not sure whether it is a fast growing economy or not. It's a report that we have heard outside. My point is a question actually. The first one is when I just go through this document and in the presentation as well, the data are just collected at different time points, like say for example the data that you presented in the Ethiopian case were collected in 2005, and it's 5 to 7 years from now, much has been changed. So is it not possible to get just up-to-date data and so that we can have a clear picture of what is really on the ground right away? The other question is, what kind of education for all? I'm really worried. If you go to Ethiopia, you can find a number of children attending schools that they don't read and write. Fourth graders, 40% of fourth graders are not reading and writing. So the government may make some kind of report just to get some kind of aid, but the pilot is highly compromised. Is there any possibility to check or control that quality just through your organization, that's UNESCO? Otherwise, it could be really difficult. Numbers could be reported, but the quality is just unbelievably low and down to the earth. So, what are you suggesting in this education for all? Is it about the number or the quality? The other point is actually so many speakers raised that you touched tangentially, that I'm still in doubt about this aid. Aid will be given to the government, but if there is no mechanism of checking whether that is really given to the people who are in need of, it would be difficult. It's really saddening just to hear that 41% of this sub-Saharan African people are not, or children are not educated. Why? If you take children of the authorities, they are attending Harvard, they are attending Oxford, they are attending elsewhere in the number one universities. But children of the poor are really suffering, leave alone just attending schools in the foreign countries of high quality education. They couldn't go to the poor quality education. So what do you suggest about these things? Maybe the points I raised may be just irrelevant, but I'm feeling this way.
Thank you. Good question. So
thank you. No, the point I think The points you are raising are very relevant and very important, and I'm happy that you have raised them. About 3 weeks or a month ago, I was in South Africa presenting this report to the Pan-African Parliament. As Parliament, Pan-African Parliament has a representation from all the parliaments in Africa. So and the president is a Nigerian senator who's the president. And I remember when I was going in there, and I said to him, I'm afraid your country is not doing too well. Am I free to say that in the parliament? And he said, oh, tell it as it is. But the interesting thing is that when we share some of these figures with the parliamentarians, a lot of them raise some of the issues that you have raised. One of the interesting things the parliamentarians raised was that the responsibility for ensuring that something is done about it has to be with their governments. This was a point that they took seriously. And I think we do say that, and I don't think I probably have made that sufficient. I've said that enough. But it is important that they take the lead. And that is recognized by the governments that they should do that. But the thing about the aid is that governments made a commitment to support. This does not refer to all countries. Some of the countries that got aid, and of course the aid has to be used properly, monitored well, ensure that it reaches those who are in need of it. Actually, the evidence suggests that when these things happen, they are able to make the progress that they make. And the international community made a commitment that if a country says, look, we can achieve these goals if you support us with funding, then, and the community makes that commitment, the point of the report is that the rich countries have to honor that commitment. And for those countries who are lagging behind, that will help. It will not solve all the problems, but that is important. I think that's how we have to look at the issue about the aid in terms of the contribution it makes. We're not saying that it shouldn't be emphasized. And like I said, the parliamentarians did emphasize that the national governments need to do more about it. Quality is very important. Education for all, for what? I think that in the Goal 6, I have raised that a lot of children go to school and do not learn to read. They are getting to grade 6 and cannot read and write. This is worrying because it has a backwards effect on households and parents who send their children to school and find out that they cannot read and write. And this is a problem that needs to be tackled, and this is something that we have highlighted, that education has to be for something. It's not simply for access, it has to lead to opportunity. And if it's not happening, then disillusionment will set in. And so you are right to say that we need to question these things, and we do raise this in our report. And then finally, the issue about data. It's a very important thing you've raised, because, again, we can only use data that maybe there's current data that some countries have, but sometimes there are issues around the data that they provide, because UIS and other data sources that we have to do a lot of check to make sure that the data that we are data that we can rely on. So, of course, sometimes we use years which are further down, and we do make that clear in the report so that there's no ambiguity about the year the data is used and the interpretation you get with. But I think it's important that a lot of developing countries improve the data they collect, and also to make that data readily available for analysis. It surprises you just how difficult it is sometimes to get good data from these countries. Something very, very difficult. And without the data, we can't do the monitoring the way that it's supposed to. So we do emphasize that the data quality is something that needs to be improved.
Thank you. And next question or comment for Dr. Onerva. Onerva Mack.
Thank you. I don't like to be talked off for a main line. I like to say something to you as an audience. But first of all, I would like to thank you for this report and comments. This UNESCO's report is a basement story for us, how to go on. And especially there has been different phases which we have passed. Let's say, since I have been working in 60 years in this area, we were very much on the same level that time than many of the countries who are now representing. here, represented here. But the progress is slow. But what you need a vision. You know, like Martin Luther King had a vision. And see how far he has come. We had a vision also to bring all the disabled children in the main line in the schools. And especially for me, it's very thrilled, very wonderful to see that one of the students of mine, a very severe CP, that time she was a child, 3 years old, she writes her literature with Morse alphabet, which is pressing her tongue to these paddles, and has taken her degree in our university, master's degree, has been working as a social worker, and now last week she was attending a community election. Of course, she didn't get much of the votes yet, but think about that person, how equal she feels to be attending this community election, even all the others who don't have this vision yet. So what can she do for the society? She can change their attitudes, and that's a very, very important thing. And one thing which I would like to say is that we have emphasized the early age very much, but we have forgotten many times the mothers who are the ones who give the first education, and those are that group of mothers we have to bring to attendance and think if we teach them to read, but they don't have anything to read. Why do we teach them to read? Or if they learn to read and have some poems or some stories to read, how does it help them in the future? Why is that all trouble? Is it better to do something for the future of the child? And now I noticed in this report that you have emphasized the second phase, the skills training in the future. We have underestimated, undervalued the skill training. We have overvalued the research, university academic research, but not so much the skills research and the skills knowledge. During the time I've been training the teachers for different types of handicap that time, we have always had in mind that everything should be based to the latest research. All the research funding should be taken into the picture. But it has to be taken, we have to learn also to use the research to make programs and to learn do the programs which are most effective ways of the skills training, especially how these skills are needed in our society, which skills we are training. We have to see that what is the need of the community, where these skills are needed, so that the persons could get a job. And there is a very nice, comment on page 23. There are Ethiopian lady who says that if someone can give me, if someone can give me the skills and the opportunity to work, I know I can achieve my goals. That's important. That is an uneducated Ethiopian lady, which is very wise. Now we come to the point that, which I like to tell you, you are the future. You should have the vision and you should keep your vision. Don't mind if it takes 60 years. to fulfill. I'm still here. The second thing is that you cannot do alone anything. You need a good company. You need a very good social network around you. But don't exclude people who are important. Politicians, you don't need to be a politician yourself, but you have to have contact with the politicians because they make the decisions. How to talk with the politicians? Let them make them feel that they are very important. Second thing is, you need to have your own personal work so that you are not afraid of a disabled person. Many times I have been teaching in university 28 years. I have learned many things. Sometimes a very talented researcher who do research about the disabled persons. But what happens when she sees the disabled person? She runs away because she doesn't know how to behave with that person, which she has been written very nice international articles about. So be humble, but don't lose your own dignity, your own self-respect. Because if you don't have respect yourself, you cannot give it to the other people either. So there are some things, you see, I'm an old person already dropping out, but I like to be throwing you up, not lifting you up, throwing you up, because time is money. Now we live in economic depression time, and you know, it's also a good thing that now the people, the economic people and so on, need education. When they have everything good, they don't need education. But now, when they don't know how to get money, they need someone who can tell what kind of education is needed. So every point has two sides. Try to always select the better one. But the bad sides are the ones which also gives you strength to struggle with these problems and see that your vision is the one with values. Thank you.
Thank you very, very much, Onerva, for those nice words and reminding us about the visions that you saw 60 years ago, and you still see them very far into the future. And the visions are the crucial things when we want to develop, we want to help the world to become a better place to live here. And this was the last comment and question for the audience because it was so nice comment for all of us. And before we continue a little further, if you don't hesitate, Onerva, I will reveal one kind of a secret yet. There will be established a new school here in Jyväskylä. Two special schools will be merged together in the beginning of next year. And this is only for your knowledge, because I know that this school will publish the name of the school later by themselves, but I only reveal it to you and don't talk to anybody else. The school will be nominated Onerva Mäki School. So this school will carry her name. And this was a very nice decision by the administration of that school and the proposal, and also for the Ministry of Education and Culture, who really also accepted the name of the school like that. So let's keep in mind that this will be also a visionary school for children with disabilities to offer them a good education, not only in Finland and Scandinavia, but also globally. Yes. Okay, so dear Mama Mackie and the rest of you, now we will proceed further, and thank you, Professor Hagjempo, thank you, Henny, for coming us and sharing information. Next.